This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Amid Bangladesh's recent political turmoil, disturbing videos of brutal attacks on Hindus flooded social media. However, many, including journalists, dismissed them as fake news. Join me, Sahar Zand, to hear how many Hindus in the country are now living in fear.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Ed Butler, and on today's edition, we're going to be hearing from Syria as it destroys what had been its number one cash export, highly addictive amphetamines.
Here in this place, the general security now are burning big amounts of like Captagon or marijuana or any other drugs.
How does Syria pay its way in future, though, we're asking. Also in the show, could Slovakia really be about to switch off Ukraine's electricity supply? And taxing trash, why Europe's metal recycling industry could become a casualty of Donald Trump's tariffs. But we start today's programme in the United States, where President Biden has blocked the takeover of US Steel. It is the nation's third biggest steelmaker. It was due to be taken over by the Japanese company Nippon Steel. But in a written statement, the president said that a strong, domestically owned and operated steel industry represents an essential national security priority. This is because steel powers our country, he said. And without domestic steel production and domestic steel workers, our nation is less strong and less secure. Well, President-elect Donald Trump has already echoed that view on his social media accounts. Nippon Steel had been prepared to pay nearly $15 billion for the American steel giant. But Terry Haynes, a spokesman for Pangea policy in Washington, believes the decision will have wider diplomatic consequences.
One of the things that's difficult about this decision was that, you know, Japan's a very close U.S. ally. There's never been a public breath to suggest that Nippon Steel ownership would cause United States national security problems. So the government's got, a big evidentiary burden here in order to justify what they're doing today. And it hurts, you know, it hurts bilateral relations with Japan.
An evidentiary burden, he thinks. Well, to get more detail on that, I've been speaking to Professor Stephen Nagy. He's the of the Department of Politics and International Studies at the International Christian University in Tokyo. I asked him to gauge his reaction to this news from Japan.
I think this is a political agenda. Remember when the Biden administration came in, Jake Sullivan put out a foreign policy for the middle class. And this was a direct response and a continuation of the Trump MAGA agenda of making America great again. And the Biden administration couldn't appear weak on foreign businesses, whether it's an ally or an adversary buying American businesses. And as a result, I think they've made this choice thinking that they need to be, putting American workers first.
Right. American workers themselves, though, in the form of the unions, think that there's potential sort of asset stripping here, that this could just be a case of Nippon Steel moving in and cutting output in mainland America.
Well, I do think that there is those voices. I think the evidence or the proof is in the pudding, and the Nippon Steel Company has really put out a lot of effort to try and allay those concerns, demonstrate that it's in for the long term, demonstrate that its interest is in the American worker and preserving American steel, and try to improve that capacity. Whether they would, over 10 or 15 or 20 years, reduce production, that's a different story, but they again made those commitments to allow the United States government to have a veto right on any reduction. That suggests that they're committed. They want to again contribute to the middle class and contribute to ensuring that U.S. steel production is in the U.S., although perhaps managed by the Nippon Steel Company.
Do you expect Nippon Steel to take legal action against this ruling?
You know what, I think right now, I think that they may sit back and be patient. I did think they expected it. I think what they may try to do once the president-elect Donald Trump does come into power on January 20th, give some time, and then come back and negotiate with him, understanding that they want more for the American worker, more guarantees. but the deal won't be substantially different than the Biden administration. But it will give the incoming president, you know, the bragging rights to say, look, I made a better deal with Nippon Steel.
There is obviously the suspicion, and you've raised this, of political interference in what technically is supposed to be an independent process by the Committee on Foreign Investment on this. They were divided when it came to making a decision on this acquisition or this potential acquisition by Nippon Steel. I suppose a legal challenge would potentially expose that political interference, and that, I suppose, could have implications for other potential takeovers involving foreign investors in U.S. companies.
So, you know, I think it's a really good point, but I think that looking at the broader U.S.-Japan relationship, the U.S.-Japan alliance, it really is the cornerstone of Japan's security. Japan prioritizes that alliance and American engagement over everything else. And I think that the government and Nippon Steel may come to a quiet agreement that right now it may not be worth going to court to try and change the decision of the CFIUS committee. Rather, it may be in the interest of waiting 6 months, offer Mr. Trump a slightly better deal to help him claim credit for protecting workers. And that may be the opportunity to continue this deal.
That's Professor Stephen Nagy. Well, no explicit comment from Nippon Steel itself so far. Natasha Abdahaj is a fund manager, global equities at Artemis Investment Management, joining us now. Hi, Natasha. Unsurprisingly, US Steel share price has dropped on this news.
Hi, Ed. Yes, no, it is seen maybe more broadly as just being another step away from that more open investment policy that's long characterized the US economy for most of this century and a lot of the last. And maybe the movement in share prices is reflecting that. I mean, this one is probably more significant just because it is Japan, who is seen as a US ally, and it's actually even happened after an election where the Democrats have already lost in any case. So Biden blocking this is just another sign of how far that middle ground of trade policy has really moved. I mean, the markets are hoping for more mergers and acquisitions activity, especially with Trump coming in on a deregulation agenda. But this is not really a sign of what might be hoped for by foreign companies looking at takeovers of the US, and may well embolden Trump on him using investments and tariffs to extract political concessions ahead.
Indeed. I mean, that comment was made, isn't it? Blocking this deal could dissuade international investors from pitching in to US companies, particularly companies with a unionized workforce, which is as noisy as the one the steelworkers are there.
Exactly that. And I think we will be watching to see how Trump reacts, because it's if he uses it as more of that kind of art of the deal going ahead, then actually that might be seen as a positive. So far, it's a wait and see.
Yeah. Apple has agreed to pay $95 million to settle a lawsuit in the US accusing its voice assistant, or Siri, of listening in on private conversations. How big a deal is this, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this one is a continuation of this theme we've seen in recent years of legal cases against big tech. I mean, this one's been brought by users, in this case, a class action centered on issues of privacy. But we're also seeing several cases being brought by regulators, the big one being the ongoing Department of Justice anti-monopoly case against Google. But this settlement does look relatively small change for Apple in the scheme of things. $95 million is not a lot compared to $65 billion of cash and equivalents on their balance sheet. So we don't expect really much of a dent to the share price, but maybe it's more of a sign of things to come, especially as these tech companies are starting to monetize in the era of AI. The data that these AI models need to train off may well be another area of privacy contention ahead as well.
Indeed. Users involved in this class action can expect up to $20 each if you are successful. You're an Apple iPhone user and you consider yourself to have been listened in on. Now, the former British Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg is stepping down from his role as Chief Global Affairs Officer at Meta. This is an interesting one. Again, seems politically well-timed, doesn't it, ahead of Donald Trump taking office.
Yeah, it's a well-timed one. I mean, Meta has played a much better game in this last election round, staying a more neutral role. Maybe Nick Clegg stepping back and being replaced with somebody who has maybe more of a Republican slant is beneficial to the company and seen as a less politicized area that can be seen for contention for Meta ahead.
Natasha El Abdahaj, thank you very much.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
Indeed. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Let's switch focus to Syria now and to a question that has become ever more urgent since the collapse of Bashar al-Assad's regime earlier this month. Well, last month, I beg your pardon. What exactly is the future of the country's economy? The foreign ministers of France and Germany are visiting Damascus today, the latest Western diplomats to have talks with the Islamist leadership who overthrew the Assad government last month, all with a view, it seems, to at least discussing the question of the lifting of EU sanctions on Syria. The country has been under one of the world's harshest sanctions regimes since the onset of the civil war there 14 years ago. And the new coalition in charge in Damascus has been appealing to Western nations for help in restoring a functioning administration, in part by destroying a large narcotics deposit or the facilities that make it inside Syria. We've been hearing from residents of one affected suburb of the capital.
Mohamed Al-Omar, I
am Mohamed Al-Omar, a resident of the Al-Dimas area near Damascus. This has always been a high security district, affiliated with the military, and there were always strange movements in the area. Trucks entering and exiting the villa constantly. But we never knew what was going on inside. We had suspicions, of course, that these headquarters were affiliated with Maha al-Hassad, the president's brother. And we were scared to approach these buildings because they threatened any civilians who went close.
Mohammed had good reason to be afraid. The Al-Dimas villa turns out to have been one of several factories discovered since the collapse of the Assad regime, equipped to produce industrial volumes of illegal narcotics. Abu Abdu Kamal was one of the first militia fighters to enter the building.
We couldn't enter the place at first because of the intensity of the smell of chemicals. We had to secure protective masks. And when we entered, we discovered that this is the main lab in the area for manufacturing the amphetamine Captagon, ecstasy and narcotic hashish. There were also barrels containing Viagra and other chemical materials that we couldn't identify. It was a production line for many types of drugs.
Well, now, those drugs are being destroyed. Hutaifa al-Hamoud is the official who's been in charge of destroying all the drugs and their chemical components.
We are in the security square in Kafr Susa, in one of the branches that was under the control of the Assad and Iran. Here, in this place, the general security now are burning big amounts of, like, Captagon or marijuana or any other drugs that was prepared to be exported to many countries like the Gulf countries and other countries. This was under the control of both the regime and Iran.
Well, Captagon is a highly addictive amphetamine, of course, that Syria is thought to have been exporting in large quantities throughout the Middle East for years now. So what does it mean for Syria and the region if the illegal drugs trade ceases? Caroline Rose is a director of the New Lines Institute and an expert on the drugs trade in the Middle East. I asked, first of all, if, in money terms, how big a deal was this drug destruction program?
I think that as of now, after we've seen so many laboratories seized, there is going to be an inevitable balloon effect that comes out from Syria. I think that Iran-aligned networks are very well suited to inherit fragments of the Captagon trade, more so than any other state or even non-state actor. And when I talk about networks in Iraq, I primarily mean Iran-backed militias operating under the Popular Mobilization Forces. I think that already we have seen laboratories across Iraq, both in Iraq's south and in its north, that were producing Captagon, as well as storage warehouses that really did, you know, create spaces for traffickers to retransit Captagon through Kuwait, through Turkey, through Iran. And as a result, I think that these networks are going to inherit many elements of the Captagon trade. Also, additionally, it's worth noting that crystal methamphetamine and methamphetamine flows in Iraq have also been on the rise. And this is something that certainly can interact and kind of create a nexus with the Captagon trade. Now, I don't necessarily think that these actors will be able to build it up to the degree that the regime had sustained Captagon. I mean, we saw millions of pills, they were produced in these factories. These were pretty industrial scale. And so it's going to be very difficult for some of these non-state actors to acquire the materials as well as the, resources to sustain such large scale Captagon sites, and also have the immunity against law enforcement systems to sustain criminal operations. So it'll be very difficult for them to build it up to the scale that the Syrian state did.
A final thought then about Syria's economy more generally. The drug trade, perhaps the main source of income in recent years, but we now have the French and the German foreign ministers in Damascus potentially discussing, we don't know, but potentially discussing the current sanctions regime against the Syrian government and its new leadership. Presumably, that is where all the effort and the focus now is, right? I mean, Syria destroys its drug program. It says the right things publicly. This country desperately needs some Western help right now, doesn't it, to restore its economy?
Absolutely. And I think that ultimately, when it comes to sanctions relief and really restoring and rehabilitating Syria's economy, that's going to be really the important factor here. When we want to encourage individuals, community members to participate in Syria's licit formal economy, that's going to be ultimately the key. It's restoring that economy in the first place. Otherwise, you'll have individuals and criminal syndicates and communities look to the black market as a way to create alternative revenue streams. So, yes, I think that building momentum in the coming months, even weeks, it's going to be crucial to try and turn a page from trades like the Captagon trade.
That's the Middle East researcher Caroline Rose on the trade worth an estimated $10 billion for Syria at its peak. Lifting sanctions will depend on the political process going forward, according to the latest statements we're hearing today in Damascus from Germany's foreign minister. Now, on Sunday, Slovakia's Prime Minister Robert Fico announced he's going to be asking his cabinet to consider reducing the support his country provides to Ukrainian refugees living there. The latest threats follow Kyiv's decision to stop the transit of Russian gas into Slovakia and into other EU countries. Slovakia has already threatened to halt exports of electricity into Ukraine. Just before we came on air, I spoke to the BBC's Rob Cameron, who's based in Central Europe, about this.
Well, these threats started when Ukraine turned off the taps of transiting Russian gas across Ukraine and onwards into Central Europe. And the point is that Slovakia was the main point of entry for the last land pipeline entering the EU that was bringing in gas from Russia. And that's why I think the Prime Minister, Robert Fico, has taken such a firm line on this. And we know that he went to Moscow just before Christmas for that very controversial face-to-face visit with Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin. And he said, in fact, he warned that this decision by Ukraine to end the transit of Russian gas into Central Europe would have a drastic impact, he said, on all of us in the European Union. There would be shortages, prices would skyrocket. But in fact, what we've seen is that none of that has happened. The market is quite stable. And Mr. Fico's threats that this would be a catastrophe for Central Europe and indeed his own country appear to be rather empty.
They would be empty, but I guess the threat remains. If he's going to cut off or cut financial support to 130,000 Ukrainian refugees potentially in the country.
Very much so. But even there, when you look at what he said, for a start, he has said that he, as the leader of his party, and it's one of three parties in the coalition, is going to propose these retaliatory measures, which, as you say, would substantially reduce, I think he said, the benefits that Slovakia pays to the 130,000 or so Ukrainian refugees in the country. He would propose those in cabinet and argue for them. So there's no guarantee that the government would approve them. But the other of those two threats was that he would end the export of electricity to Ukraine over this. And that obviously would perhaps be of more concern to the Ukrainians, you'd think. But in fact, it seems even there his room for manoeuvre is extremely limited, because that export of electricity to Ukraine is governed by EU rules. Slovakia is an EU member, and all these arrangements are governed by contracts. And in fact, Slovakia's electricity distributor, a state-owned distributor, has said just this morning, no, we're going to carry on providing electricity to Ukraine on an ad hoc basis as and when they need it. So there, Mr. Fico's threats seem, again, to be rather empty.
So that's the Slovak Prime Minister. I mean, what are the Czechs saying in this situation?
Well, the Czechs really have dismissed Mr. Fico's threats as saber-rattling. They themselves, of course, like Slovakia, have diversified. They've made old alternative arrangements so that they're not left without gas as a result of this. The Czech Foreign Minister, Jan Lipavský, when Mr. Fico went to Moscow to see Vladimir Putin, said, this is precisely why we in the Czech Republic diversified, why we found alternative sources, in his words, so we wouldn't have to crawl on our knees before a mass murderer. So I think that gives you an indication, at least, of how Mr. Fico's diplomacy efforts and indeed his threats that this will have catastrophic implications for Europe are being taken, at least by some of his neighbours.
That's the BBC's Rob Cameron. Now, all week on World Business Report, we've been looking at the issue of tariffs. Donald Trump's return to the White House later this month could lead to much higher taxes on imports than we've seen in recent years. Companies across the world are trying to prepare for what may be coming. How is Europe getting ready to adapt? Murat Bayram is a managing director of European Metal Recycling in Germany. He joins me now. Hi, Murat. Now, recycling might not seem the most obvious industry to be in Donald Trump's crosshairs, I guess, but in fact, concerns do seem to be growing, don't they, about the rise in protectionism in this sector.
Yeah, first of all, good afternoon and happy new year, Matt. What we found out at the VDM, the German Metal Recycling Association, which hat I have on today, where I'm also on the board, is that tariffs not only distort market dynamics, but also often brings new regulations in their wake. So members and colleagues within the recycling industry, particularly those associated with the VDM, have already raised concerns about the overwhelming bureaucratic burden. So historically, you're asking about recycling and what does it have to do with us? Whenever nations have implemented protectionistic measures such as export bans or tariffs on certain recycled raw materials, recycling rates have subsequently declined. And that is actually logical. When markets shrink, so does demand. And reducing the necessity to recover raw materials from circular systems and reintegrate them into the industrial supply chains.
Right. So you'd be an indirect casualty, you're saying, if there were, for example, increased tariffs on European cars traveling to the US.
Yeah, I mean, like the uncertainty surrounding potential tariffs on EU products, such as automobiles, as you say, is already being felt. The members of our association, VDM, report that the automotive industry is producing less than usual. So this slowdown is reflected in a noticeable decrease in the volume of metals arriving at recycling facilities. And these materials typically generated during production processes or as end-of-life vehicles waste are vital inputs for the recycling industry. Mm.
European metals recycling handles 10 million tons of waste annually, I'm reading. Everything from drinks cans to oil platforms, which of course are reused, recycled and recovered. How big an industry, I mean, in cash terms, is metal recycling?
Well, it's today I'm talking to you about the German Metal Recycling Association, where I'm also on the board. The metal recycling industry is quite big, and let me just say, between the USA and Europe, we are connected in the field of circular economy. And according to the statistics we have compiled at the VDM, Europe has imported, for example, nearly 100,000 tons of recycled copper from the USA, while the USA has imported nearly 700,000 metric tons of recycled steel from Europe. So a combined weight of equivalent, just to have a clear picture about it, more than 1 million elephants, for example. Yeah. So it's quite a big market, and it's an increasing market. And what we always say is that, I mean, economics is at least 50% psychology, right? And when we're talking about tariffs, but when the future appears uncertain, usually companies in any sector are reluctant to invest, fearing that their efforts may not yield returns. So it's also in the circular economy.
How much lobbying is going on right now to keep trading corridors like yours, like those of perhaps those related industries you've described in Europe, to keep those open with the United States as we welcome the new administration into the White House?
I can only talk about the circular economy field. We're trying to convince people not to increase the protectionism. We're trying to convince the people that open markets are essential for the recycling industry, because the greater the capacity for utilizing recycled raw materials, the higher the recycling rate will be.
Okay, well, my thanks very much indeed there for Murat Bayram. He's Managing Director of European Metal Recycling in Germany. So a final thought then. We mentioned earlier the lifting sanctions on Syria. As mentioned, we were hearing from the Foreign Minister, Annalena Baerbock. She did say on Friday in Damascus, after she met the country's de facto leader, that lifting sanctions on the country would depend on the political process going forward. So she and the French Foreign Minister, who's also in the country, are keeping pretty tight-lipped about the prospects of changing the current sanctions regime. We will keep an eye on that. That is it for today's edition of World Business Report. From me and the rest of the team, take care.
For just as long as Hollywood has been Tinseltown, there have been suspicions about what lurks behind the glitz and glamour.
Concerns about radical propaganda in the motion pictures.
And for a while, those suspicions grew into something much bigger and much darker.
Are you a member of the Communist Party? Or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
I'm Una Chaplin, and this is Hollywood Exiles. It's about a battle for the political soul of America, and the battlefield was Hollywood.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.